I was saying that I don't think that swimming in a pool constitutes a bath.
Depends who you're asking and what you're doing.
I'm asking you because you just
That wasn't a
said that
question,
swimming in a
though, but it
pool.
wasn't a question.
But
You weren't asking shit.
you're still saying that.
I am
But
not
you're
saying that.
still saying that swimming in a pool is the same thing as showering.
I'm not saying that. I'm saying in a pinch. Like, if you're going through your day and your weekend is a pretty lazy weekend, you didn't have a lot going on. I think the last time I showered, I'm just going to say it was last Thursday.
What day is it now? It's Monday.
It's Monday, but I've been in the pool like four times since then, and I really haven't done much.
You cut down a tree.
Ratting me out. I said it was a lazy weekend. But I point being, I showered tonight before this recording, but I was thinking back going, I don't know, the shower felt far. I'm like, where have I haven't seen the shower? Like in a foreign place. Am I in a hotel?
This is new. What am I doing here?
Listening to Murder Unscripted.
What is up, crime crew? Welcome back to Murder Unscripted, episode 59. Of the most immersive true crime podcast on the internet today, as voted on by Melissa and I and my mom, Dawn.
Remember voting that we are the most immersive, but if you want me to vote, I will.
So it's really just two of us then. My mom and I feel like this is the most immersive true crime podcast on the internet today. I'm your host, Ed Hidock, along with my co-host and my bestie, Melissa Spivey.
Melissa is like half a vote.
Yeah, she's kind of on the fence. Well, Melissa, it is indeed week two of our month-long block entitled Girl Power.
Yes, and this month we are highlighting some of the most amazing and courageous women that have ever hit the true crime realm. Last week I told you about the monster that is a zombie hunter, aka the world's biggest incel.
That story blew my mind because of the sheer violence of it. And I'm no stranger to seeing random murders. I mean, that happens all the time, but this was like random and so over the top that it was almost unbelievable.
And just so stupidly unnecessary. Like, it was
Yeah.
just.
They all are, though.
No, you're right. But you know what? More importantly, I also shared with you how incredible Dr. Colleen M. Fitzpatrick is and how she brought justice for the two amazing, beautiful, and bright young women, Angela Brasso and Melanie Burness.
Dr. Colleen is a rock star, and I get why you're in love with her. It's pretty undeniable and understandable.
I agreed.
Well, you know what our listeners are going to love? Our amazing guest for this month. Anyone who considers themselves a true crime junkie will not want to miss this month's interview, and you will know exactly who we're talking about. We'll probably announce it next week. I hate announcing guests when they're not, we call it in the can in the TV world. So basically like in the hopper, like it done. So until her interview is done and she's in the chair, I'm not going to tell you who the guest is because it may not be, but it will come out on Tuesday, July 22nd. So definitely click that like button, click that subscribe button so you don't miss the interview or any of our other truly immersive episodes.
All right, well, let's get into my case today. First of all, I have a super amazing and badass woman named Patricia Wilshire, who I will be highlighting later in this episode. She's amazing, and she does play like a relatively small role in this case, but honestly, like without her knowledge and her expert testimony, this case wouldn't have, I don't think the conviction would have happened. I don't think they would have gotten such a strong conviction. She was really
Sure.
the link to tie our perp to the crime scene, essentially.
That's why it's really hard. This is a tough block, this girl power block, because these people work behind the front lines. You know, they're hard. They don't always get the recognition they deserve. They do within their own inner circle, but the public doesn't always see the incredible work that these people do. These women this month, but there's men that do it too. And they kind of go unrecognized, some of these analysts, because they're the true heroes as well, in addition to the cops and the prosecutors and everybody involved.
No, it's so true. And like this woman and a couple other women I came across, I was just amazed, A, at what they've done, but B, like that they aren't better well known. So this has been a hard block, but I'm glad we're doing it. We are going to come back to Patricia, but we are traveling across the pond today and heading to England.
Oh, man.
So let's preface this by saying I apologize in advance for when I inevitably pronounce something incorrectly. Good luck to me. Also, I did use several resources for this case, including a book, a few documentaries, and multiple news sources. And when I say that almost every publication had differing information, I'm not exaggerating. Like the main parts of this case are uniform across sources, but certain things were not. So I tried to figure out what was reported the most, and that's what I'm going to be telling you. I'm just putting that out there in case you read or watch something that strays from what I'm reporting. Don't be too shocked, because even the two documentaries I watched both gave different information about certain things. So with that being said, we are heading to the town of Soham, which is located in Cambridgeshire. Here we go. With that being said, we are heading to the town of Soham, which is located in Cambridgeshire, England. Probably messed that one up.
Cambridgeshire?
For reference, this... No, you don't say Shire. You say Cambridgeshire.
Like Worcestershire.
Exactly. But I can't say that either. So,
Cambridgeshire.
Anyway, sure. For reference... Soham is about two hours north of London. And Soham's a pretty small town. And in 2002, which is the time that this case takes place, the town was home to about 9,000 people. As of today, there's about 12,000.
Okay, relatively small.
Yeah. So it's Sunday, August 4th, 2002, and 10-year-old Jessica Chapman walks from her home on Brook Street to the home of her best friend, 10-year-old Holly Wells. So Jessica and her family had recently returned from vacation or holiday, and while away, she had gotten Holly a necklace with an H on it. So I'm sure she's like not only excited to see her friend, but also to give her this gift. And these girls had been besties since like nursery school, and they were really, really tight. And there isn't a ton of information about the girls, but what I really loved most is that as they got older, they started leaning into like different activities and different likes and dislikes. For example, according to sources, Jessica was more of a tomboy and into sports, and Holly was kind of more of a girly girl who excelled musically. But, like, they remained besties. So, like, instead of growing up and growing apart, they both grew in their own ways, but also together. And I really liked that because that doesn't always happen. And I think that's just such a testament to like how strong their friendship was.
I'm going through that with my daughter right now. You know, she has a couple tight-knit friends, but getting to the age where those friends start to like find other friend groups and other interests. And now is the time when I feel like you're starting to find your own identity and starting to grow apart a little bit. So the strength of that friendship is... I mean, it's all dependent on how much effort the two people want to put into it to just stick together, because it does get tough.
Yeah. And these two girls seem to be like besties through thick and thin. Cool. So Jessica heads over to Holly's home, and it's about 11:30, 11:45 in the morning. And Holly and her family live in this, I don't know what they call it in England. We would call it like a little cul-de-sac kind of, at a street called Red Gardens. And according to Google Maps, the walk between the two girls' homes should have taken less than 10 minutes. And like Google Maps has you follow the sidewalks, and the distance was less than a half mile, but it was probably even shorter if Jessica cut through like backyards or gardens. So she gets to Holly's home, and one reports out that there was another friend with them, and the girls played computer games and hung out. At some point, the other girl goes home, and Holly's family has guests arrive around 3 p.m. for a barbecue. So at 5:04 p.m., Holly's mom takes a picture of Holly and Jessica, and this picture has become incredibly famous. The girls are standing there with these big, beautiful smiles, and they're wearing matching red Manchester United jerseys, specifically David Beckham jerseys. Mm-hmm. And we know that it was 5:04 p.m. because where the picture was taken, which I'm guessing was in like Holly's living room or something, there's a clock right behind the girl. So we have this documented evidence at 5:04 p.m.
That's huge. If that picture plays a role in whatever happens here, that's going to be a great jumping off point.
And they looked so cute because, you know, like when you're that age, you want to match your best friends. So they just looked adorable in their matching jerseys. And apparently they were big football fans or American soccer.
Well, it's just like the NFL over here. How many kids do you see wearing NFL jerseys?
Exactly.
And David Beckham was huge, especially in 02. He was the premier name.
Oh, seriously. So the girls eat dinner with Holly's parents and the people who were visiting. And then at about 6:15 p.m., the girls decide to walk to this local sports center to get candy from the vending machine. And from what I read, this sports center, I think it was kind of like a community rec center or like similar to like a YMCA like we have in the States.
Sure.
And so the girls leave. Well, Holly's parents, who were entertaining their guests, they thought the girls had gone upstairs and were unaware that the girls had left the home. And FYI, with the sources, this timeline comes from The Guardian and also from CNN. It was reported that at 6:17 p.m., the girls were seen on CCTV footage near the sports center. And then at 6:30 p.m., a woman who supposedly knew the girls saw them near Sand Street. And this would be the last confirmed sighting of the girls. And Sand Street is most likely the route that they would have taken to get from Holly's house to the sports center.
Okay.
So at some point that night, between like 8:30 p.m., Holly's parents become aware that the girls aren't at the home. So Holly's mother calls Jessica's mother, and Jessica's mom's like, no, like they're not here either. And at 8:40 p.m., Jessica's mom calls Jessica's cell phone, but it had been turned off.
God, can you imagine? I know as a parent, when you throw a party, it's great because all the kids get together and all the kids that are at the party usually go off together and kind of you get some adult time. The kids have fun together. They are kind of out of sight, out of mind. So I can't even imagine how the vibe of that party changed the second someone was like, where are the girls?
And just so everyone's aware, like this was very out of character that the girls would go off on their own. And not only that, but that Jessica's phone was off. Like that was
a
big
scary
red flag. Yeah, and both girls were very responsible, and Jessica was known to be very diligent about checking in via her cell phone with her family. So the families begin looking for the girls, and then at 9:56 p.m., a call is placed to the local police to report the girls missing. The police arrive to Holly's home about 35 minutes later, and they begin taking information, and then a search for the girls begins. And not just the police, like at this point, it's the girls' families and neighbors had started to assist in the search as well.
Oh, absolutely. It's all hands on deck and everybody get out there and check everywhere they're known to hang out and all the places they're not known to hang out. You check everywhere.
Everywhere. And they even called the little girl who had been like at the house earlier with the girls. Like I heard one report that the police were at her house at like 2 a.m. waking this little girl up to be like, do you know where they could have gone? So the search goes basically through the night and then picks up again at dawn with police and volunteers. They're combing the town and the surrounding countryside. And early on, it seems like authorities believe the girls may have simply wandered off and gotten lost in this vast rural landscape. Because while it's in the town, it's also kind of like the rolling hills that you like see in movies about England, you know? So it's kind of like almost in the middle of nowhere. That's kind of how it looked.
But you know what? If these girls were as responsible as you're saying in that sources claim, it's strange for them to be out there without telling anyone.
Agreed. But again, how many times have we heard police be like, oh, they're runaways? And the parents are like, my child has never run away in a billion years. Like, what
I was glad. And I don't know how things work in England, but I was waiting for you to say that. Be like, they had to wait 24 hours. And I'm like, please don't say that. Please be better, England.
Well, that's a really good transition to my next section. I want to go on record and be fully transparent I am not familiar enough with the criminal justice system or police procedures in the United Kingdom to deeply analyze or criticize how this investigation was handled. That said, there has been a fair amount of criticism, particularly around the actions taken or not taken in those critical first hours after the girls went missing. From the documentaries I watched, and a huge inquiry like ended up being done, and I read through that, and it appears that this was a relatively small and less experienced police force, and they were suddenly faced with an overwhelming situation.
I get it to an extent, but you said it best when you were describing the first critical hours. Like, critical is the key word there, because they are so important to saving these girls' lives.
One documentary I watched was referring to this as like the golden hour.
If they were taken by someone, every single minute that ticks by is 1 minute closer to that person getting further away from police.
Later on, we'll go into some of the documented missteps and some of the changes that this brought about, which seems to kind of be the rules of true crime. Something horrible has to happen for us to get Megan's Law or whatever, you know, like for us to set a precedent.
Sad but true.
So we do know that on Monday, which was the first full day of the investigation, police went door to door, like canvassing the area. And they also set up like a press conference. They had the parents, like the girls' parents, speak to the media, pleading for their safe return. And to their credit, law enforcement quickly brought in outside help. Like, I will always commend a police force that's willing to set aside ego and ask for support. I think that kind of humility, especially in an environment that can often be territorial, I think that's something that we need to commend and I have a lot of respect for. So I will give them that credit.
It's so good that they brought in that help early, knowing that they're not equipped to handle a case like this. So that's a check mark for them.
And again, and this is so like sad to have to say, but like, the system had failed these girls long before police ever got involved. By the time they went missing, even if investigators had done everything exactly right by the book, I don't think the outcome would have changed. And again, we're going to come back to this and talk about where things kind of went awry. Back to the girls. Again, it's Monday, August 5th, and the police did the press conference with the girls' parents, and they're so sad. Like, this interview and press conference is just so sad. Both parents are crying, and the one, Nick, I think you pronounce it Nicola, that's Holly's mom. She's just like, if you have children, like, you know how hard this is. Like, you know what we're going through. And they're crying. It's so heartbreaking. Meanwhile, police are going door to door asking anyone and everyone, you know, what they may have seen. And they come across a 28-year-old man named Ian Huntley. And he lived not far from the girls and not far from, like, the sports center. He's kind of in the middle. So what I haven't told you thus far is kind of the layout of the area of Soham where the girls had been spotted. I talked about Sand Street, which was the road the girls would have most likely walked to reach the sports center. Well, off of Sand Street, there are two schools. One was St. Andrew's Primary School, which is where Holly and Jessica were students. And the other school is Soham Village College, which is different than in the United States, like a secondary school for ages 11 to 16.
Like a middle school, yeah.
Yeah. So Ian lived on the property of Soham Village College as he was the caretaker of the property. So part of like his employment arrangement was that he and his fiance, who's 25-year-old Maxine Carr, they got to live in the caretaker's home, which was located at 5 College Close. So he works at the Soham Village College, and then Maxine was employed at St. Andrew's Primary School, and she's like some sort of teacher's aide, classroom assistant. And this is noteworthy because not only did Holly and Jessica attend St. Andrew's, but they both knew and they were close with Maxine as she actually worked in their classroom.
Okay.
And just a little side note here, this is one of the spots that those differing reports comes in. Many reports said that Ian was the caretaker at the girls' school, but that's not the truth. He was the caretaker, but the schools are like almost on the same campus. So okay. He was the caretaker of the Soham Village College. They went to St. Andrew's Primary School.
Okay, so it's the same kind of campus-ish
area. Yeah. So an officer is at Ian's house talking to him, and Ian proceeds to tell the officer that he had seen Holly and Jessica the night before, and actually, he may have been one of the last people to see the girls. He goes on to explain that around 6:45, he had been outside of his house with his dog when the girls walked past the home. He said they stopped to say hello to him and ask how Miss Carr, aka Maxine, was doing. Their concerns stemmed from the fact that Maxine's employment at their school for the upcoming year had been denied. Like, I guess each year she had to reapply for the position she was working, and she had gotten turned down.
I think they do, like, they kind of reassess payroll, and they reassess what positions are necessary, and they make cuts and stuff. So I imagine that being an assistant or a teacher's aide would be kind of a, almost like a temp basis that needs to get renewed.
Yeah. So this news had upset the girls, especially Holly, who had actually even made a card for Maxine, like, expressing her upset that Maxine wouldn't be their classroom assistant anymore. So, like, it makes sense that they would ask Ian how she was doing. So Ian's telling this to the officers, and, he tells the officer that he told the girls that Maxine was bummed. So the girls asked Ian to pass along their condolences. They said their goodbyes, and that was it. And the girls walked away, and while he could point in the direction that they were heading, he hadn't asked where they were going. I also want to point out the fact that while Ian didn't come out and say it, he did allude to the officers that Maxine was in the home when the girls stopped by. So just keep that in mind. And the officer who spoke to Ian seemed to accept his account of the interaction, but still asked to look around Ian's home and search the school grounds, both of which Ian agreed to, and really nothing noteworthy was found other than the officer remarking the home smelled of cleaning product. But my kitchen smells like cleaning projects right now because I was cleaning the kitchen. So
yeah, but when you got missing girl, I mean, yeah.
What we don't find out until later, and here's a little bit of the miscommunication, lack of coordination, missteps that I was referring to earlier. An officer had actually spoken to Ian the night before on Sunday the 4th when the girls first went missing. And he originally had told this officer, nope, haven't seen him. Don't know what you're talking about. No girls here. Yeah. But then later that evening, he would tell one of the neighborhood searchers that he had seen the girls around 6:15.
Oh, differing stories already.
Exactly. And it's also different because he originally had told the cop on Monday that he saw them at 6:45. So our time's changing. Our story's already changing. So the searcher's like, all right, well, you got to tell the police. So Ian reluctantly does. And when he tells the police, I think they're kind of like, why didn't you tell us this earlier when we asked you? And he explains that, you know, he knew two girls were missing, but he didn't put it together that it was the same girls he had seen earlier in the night.
How many missing girls are on a daily basis?
My response to that is, sure, Jan. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
So during this middle of the night conversation, the officer asks Ian to look around the grounds of the school, which Ian obliged. However, when they get to one building, which was known as the hangar, Ian claimed he didn't have the keys to this building. So according to sources, the officer banged on the door to this building, but she didn't see or hear anything suspicious and she moved on. So meanwhile, searches are intensifying, and at the time of our case, this was one of the most, if not the most, extensive and like costly investigations in England's history.
Really?
Oh my gosh. They pulled out all the stops for this. That's why this is such a hard case, because there are definitely missteps and definitely things that should have been handled differently, but it's like they went into it with all they had. It's just that they didn't quite have it.
Well, and if this is such a high-profile case, they're extra under the microscope. So every mistake is going to get magnified, and every success is going to get magnified, too.
And it's always easy after the fact to be like, you did this wrong.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
So the next day is Tuesday, August 6th, and the authorities are still thinking that maybe the girls got lost, or maybe they ran away, and they also knew that the girls spent a lot of time playing on their computers, because remember, I had said they were playing computer games the day at Holly's house. So they definitely had to consider that maybe the girls had gone off to like meet someone in a chat room. Like, this is 2002, like age, sex, location, ASL.
Absolutely.
Like, that's big right now.
Absolutely, it is.
So that could absolutely happen. And again, like the parents and the other family members, they're all in the media spotlight pleading for information. And actually, even David Beckham, Mr. Posh Spice himself, makes a public appeal for the girls to come home.
That's very cool. And that's how celebrities should be using their status, not to talk about politics, not to talk about all these current affairs, like use it for good. You have this audience, you have this platform, use it.
Seriously. And like for David Beckham to do that, like, I don't really have an opinion about him one way or the other, but like, that's awesome.
He's a good looking man, Melissa.
He really is. So over the next 11-ish days, the entire country, really the entire world, was glued to their TVs watching this pretty much 24/7 media coverage. I mean, the media had descended on this town, and we know that the media, especially in like the UK, can be incredibly brutal. Like,
yeah, fact.
So police from surrounding towns and cities had been brought in, and hundreds of people are helping with the search efforts. Police were getting hundreds of tips and they're following up on them. But again, this is kind of hindering the investigation rather than helping, because they're wasting resources. They have people being like, oh, I saw the girls get into a car. Oh, they got into separate cars, or they were dragged into a car, or a taxi driver had them in a car. You know, if they were here, they were there.
When they get an influx of tips like this, it does more harm than good sometimes. But the problem is, any one of these little tips could be the missing link, could be the answer. So you do have to follow up on it. It takes time. It takes manpower, especially when the tip is like, I saw a girl in a taxi. Like, it's not just like a taxi with this plate number, or I saw a girl getting in a car. Oh, I don't remember the color of the car. So, you know, it's like when the more generic the tip is, I mean, man, it's so hard.
It's tough. And basically all these leads proved fruitless. So this entire community is in shock. I mean, they were having vigils and prayer services at St. Andrew's, and it's like Holly and Jessica became daughters to the entire town. And reading about this and how it affected the community really gave me Delphi, Indiana vibes. Yes. Delphi was a much smaller town, but just the idea of something so earth-shattering taking hold of this sleepy little town that was barely a blip on the map before.
And it changes the fiber of your community. So now that becomes what you're known for. So all the work that you've done from a community standpoint to have gatherings and have street fairs and have organizations that promote coming together, and this really strong, I mean, 9,000 people is not big. So I imagine that was a pretty strong community. So then to see something like this happen, it's like everything, all the good we've done is now just overshadowed by this really black cloud.
I mean, this is literally known as the SOA murders.
It's awful for them.
So by August 14th, 2002, which is 10 days after Holly and Jessica went missing on the 4th, the initial hope of the girls leaving on their own had been all but extinguished. And after the first initial 4 or 5 days of the investigation, they began to theorize that the girls had possibly been abducted and were being held captive somewhere. But again, as the days are going on, the idea that the girls were being held alive somewhere was fading.
Yep. And every day that passes, that it's hard to imagine a good outcome.
Exactly. So the next day, August 15th, one of the main reporters for Sky News, his name's Jeremy Thompson, and he's on a ton of the documentaries. He and his camera crew decided to retrace the last known route that the girls had taken. So on this route, they come across Ian Huntley, and they decide to interview him.
Oh,
so,
wow.
This is not something we generally do, but Ed, I have not showed you this clip, so I want to pause our recording, and I want you to sit here right now and watch this interview. It's not long, and we can play it for our listeners.
Okay.
You're the school caretaker. The girls, Jessica and Holly, would know you, and they saw you on the front doorstep. What went on?
Well, I don't know the girls. I was still on the front doorstep grooming my dog down. She'd run away and come back a bit of a mess. They just came across and asked how Miss Carr was, as she used to teach them at St Andrews. I just said she weren't very good as she hadn't got the job. And they just says, please tell her that we're very sorry. And off they walked in the direction of the library over there.
How did they seem to you?
They seemed fine, very cheerful, happy, chatty. I didn't see anything untoward, nobody hanging around. You know, they just seemed like normal, happy kids.
Safe and well?
Yeah, absolutely.
And you may, as it turned out, have been the last person to actually chat to them before they vanished.
Yeah, that's what it seems like.
And it's a mystery.
Absolutely,
still unsolved.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, everybody round here, I mean, I've been speaking to a lot of people, and what they're saying is, you know, while there's no news, then there's still that glimmer of hope, and that's basically all we're all hanging on to.
And there was nothing that Sunday evening that gave you a glimmer of suspicion that anything was wrong?
No, not at all.
Okay, so a couple things. One, it's striking to me how incredibly calm and chill this guy is, that if he turns out to be the person who did this, handled the questions very well, because the reporter definitely hammered him as if he were a detective. He was asking some pretty leading questions, trying to get him to maybe confess or like, or do you know more? That, like, I don't know if you could tell that, but that reporter had a tone. He had a very, he was prying for information, and Ian Huntley had answers ready. He didn't panic. He just said whatever his version of the events were. He paused a little bit and had to kind of recompose himself when the guy flat out said, kind of put that thought in his head where he was like, you were one of the last persons to see them, and you didn't see anything. Like, you could see him like stop and think a second, but I mean, overall very composed, very, very calm, very innocent looking.
Yes, agreed. Unassuming, normal Joe.
Yes.
Now, the first thing that I noticed when I watched this is the reporter, Jeremy Thompson, leads Ian in by saying, Ian Huntley, you're the caretaker. The girls would have known you and saw you on the front doorstep. So what went on? The first thing out of Ian's mouth was, I don't really know the girls. Which to me sets off alarm bells, because it's like his first priority is to remove or distance himself from the situation.
Distance yourself from the situation, from the individual, from any evidence. Or what did he say? There weren't any bad people around or any weirdos around or something like that. So he's already throwing
something
out situations
like,
so I don't know. It was interesting.
Well, we'll go into it a little bit more. I will say, if anyone's interested, there are like studies upon studies on this interview. Like, there are body language specialists.
On that interview there, that little news clip?
Just that little minute and 10 seconds. There are countless. Like, if you were to type that in, your first like 10 pages of Google would be like different people being like, the way he put his hand in this part and the way his voice changed in this part. So it's very interesting. I would have liked to go more in it, but we'd be here all night.
Yeah, I get that.
So that same day that Sky News talks to Ian, they also interview Maxine. And remember, Maxine is Ian's girlfriend, fiance, I don't know. So again, Ed, I want you to watch this interview. We're going to play it for our listeners, and then I want to get your opinion about it afterwards. Really listen to how she's talking and what she's saying.
Got it. Okay, stand by.
You knew the girls. What were they like? Tell us a bit about them.
Lovely, really bubbly girls. They're ever so funny, brilliant, they're kind to everybody. They wouldn't say a bad word about anybody. And they love the families and everything, which is why nobody believes that they would ever run away. They was very close to all their family.
Tell us something about this card you're holding.
This is something I'll probably keep for the rest of my life, I think. It's what Holly gave me on the last day of term. She was very, very upset because I didn't get my job. And she just gave me this with a poem on the inside saying to a special teaching assistant, really. And we'll miss her a lot and we'll see her in the future. And that's the kind of girl she was. She was just lovely, really lovely.
That's really very sweet, isn't it?
Yeah.
Any thoughts tonight? I mean, 11 days is a long time. I mean, if they could see you now, what would Maxine Carr say to Holly and Jessica?
Just get on the phone and just come home. Just come home. Or if somebody's got them, just let them go. Doesn't matter where you let them go, as long as you just let them go and let them come home.
Yo, cue the crow. Do you hear her talking in past tense? Some of her sentences, like the girls were or the girl was. But at the same time, I'm wondering if that's not what I'm hearing, because her accent is tough. Like, if this is all past tense, she knows exactly what happened to those girls and she knows Ian did it. Or if it was present tense, she really is in the dark with everything. And if Ian did do it, then she doesn't know about it.
You hit the nail on the head with the past tense. And I do have the transcript. And there's at one point where Jeremy Thompson asks, what are the girls like? And her response is lovely, really bubbly girls. They were ever so funny, brilliant, kind to everybody. They wouldn't say a bad word about anybody. Mm-hmm. And then later she says they was very close to all their family. So we have were and was. So the news crew, they're kind of like, is this a big deal, essentially? Is the past tense, is what she said a big deal? So they do decide to bring this information to authorities. And throughout this investigation, I think that with the police, their investigative spidey senses had been tingling that something about Ian was just a little off. Mm-hmm. But they had such an overwhelming list of people to consider that while Ian was on it, I don't think they looked into him as hard as they probably should have, which you pointed this out earlier. All of that being said, hindsight is 20/20.
Right.
Now, over the course of the days where the girls were missing, however, Ian had made himself like almost a central part of this investigation. He was checking in with police. He's asking questions. He's offering suggestions, which one could look at as being helpful and expressing concern for the girls.
Oh, shit.
Or like when he's asking questions like, how long does DNA last? And exactly. How long does it take to get DNA results back? That could be looked at as someone trying to gain intel into what the police actually knew.
And that's what it is. It's not even about being overly friendly so that people won't think you had anything to do with it. It's, I need to know what they know so that I know what my next step needs to be. Yeah.
I feel like I would do something like that. Like, I'd be like, oh my God, how long does it take for a body to do? But that's just pure, like, fascination.
If you're ever being suspected of a crime, do me a favor and do not ask, how long does it take a body to decompose?
Okay, I would get caught in 5 seconds because I can't keep a secret and I giggle when I'm nervous. So I would be sitting there giggling and sweating and being like, guess what I did? Because I can't keep a secret.
Wow.
Well, after police see this interview, especially with Maxine, that like slight feeling of something is kind of off here has now turned into like a blazing fire of red flags for the investigators. Wow. So the next day, August 16th, Ian and Maxine are both brought in to sit down and speak with police. And these interviews were conducted separately, and they ended up being questioned for about 7 hours that Friday.
That's no joke.
Yeah. So let's stop and take a minute to talk about this demon couple from hell. And to play devil's advocate here, Maxine Carr is ultimately a victim of Ian Hunt. I'll explain some of her backstory, but she was most definitely abused and manipulated by him.
Okay.
There's several instances where people physically saw him abusing her, laying hands on her. All of that being said about Maxine, I think that in this case, there is a very large gray area in regard to her being a victim and her being an accomplice. I lean towards one direction, but I wasn't there. I wasn't a part of their relationship, and I wasn't in her headspace.
Right. And I think it's important to just present the facts and let the audience decide, you know?
Yes. So we're going to start with Ian. Born on January 31st, 1974 in Grimsby, England, Huntley was the first son of blue-collar couple Kevin and Linda Huntley. His younger brother, Wayne, came along about a year later. Now, depending on which source you believe, Huntley's early childhood was either relatively calm or hardy, showing major signs of dysfunction. There are some reports that kind of paint his early life like this domestic bliss, at least for the first couple years, but others suggest Ian was apparently insanely jealous of the attention that Wayne, his little brother, received, like, mm-hmm. especially from their mother. He craved being the center of attention and didn't like sharing the spotlight, even within his own family. He would apparently throw wild tantrums if his mother, like, even looked towards his younger brother.
Now we can look to the childhood again of these people, because look at what happened. Remember when Kirk mm-hmm. was interviewing, he was telling us about the woman who self-stalked herself, and the whole motive for that was because all of her friends were getting pregnant and she wasn't getting that attention. So she was willing to act out in a less murderous way. But if this guy turns out to do it, you can kind of point to, like, something in his childhood again.
But the sad thing is, with this guy's childhood, to me, there's nothing that stands. Like, there's some murderers who were, like, horrifically abused as children, physically, sexually, emotionally. And that didn't necessarily happen with Ian. He suffered from asthma as a child, which, like, same girl, you're not special. But, like, he made this a huge deal and was apparently always, like, faking asthma attacks, again, to get attention. And, like, mm-hmm. he was known to struggle with an asthma, but alongside his physical health issues, he struggled socially. He was an awkward kid. He didn't know how to relate to other children. He became an easy target for schoolyard bullies. There were actually some accounts that kids even called him Spadehead because of his unusually large forehead.
I worked with a guy we called Stop Sign Face because he had rosacea.
Oh, that's mean.
Anyway.
So to cope with this bullying and to try to gain some kind of, like, status, Ian began crafting elaborate lies about his life. And, like, this started as a young child. And this was the beginning of what would ultimately become a lifelong pattern of deception and manipulation. And, like, his stories weren't just harmless exaggerations. They were, like, calculated moves to gain attention or pity or power. And there was one story about how, like, he told everyone his dad died and, like, his whole class rallied around him. And then they find out that his dad's not dead. Hmm. Like, it was just strange things that he would make up.
Yeah.
I also read a few reports that he had attempted suicide when he was a child. However, these reports are pretty much like they weren't serious attempts. They were more for attention.
Okay.
Regardless, I do think it's sad if a child is trying to do that. So yeah, I don't know, you know, what was going on in his head. Right. So academically, Ian really didn't fare much better. He struggled in school and eventually left with, like, minimal qualifications. As I mentioned, his relationships with his peers were strained. His teachers often described him as moody, aggressive, and dishonest. And at home, tensions increased around the home, like, as he got older. His relationship with his father, Kevin, was reportedly distant and cold, and although his mother was much more nurturing, she wasn't able to rein in, like, his growing behavioral problems. And Ian would later go on and tell people that his father was abusive and had affairs, and from what I could find, that wasn't necessarily the truth. His parents did split up due to an affair, I believe on his father's part, but they reconciled. Eventually, though, I believe when Ian was in his late teens, maybe early 20s, his mom would leave his father for good and she began dating a woman. And Ian blamed his father for this, which would further damage their already fragile relationship.
It's sad. I mean, if you ask me, because this kid was clearly crying. He needed something. And I don't know what that something is. I'm not a psychologist, but he was crying out for help and didn't get it. And now something happened.
I think we've all been jealous of a sibling at some point or felt, you know, intimidated or whatever. But the fact that he was so little and jealous, like, what kind of 2-year-old is jealous? I don't know. To me, that just seems... Like, I could see a child being like, oh, the new baby came home and he's getting more attention than me. But it sounds like he took it to another level.
Yeah, definitely.
So by the time he reached his teenage years, Ian's issues had only intensified. He began dating younger, very vulnerable girls, showing these early signs of predatory and controlling tendencies that would later go on to define his crimes. And he had an obsession with like authority and status, but he really lacked the maturity and emotional intelligence to actually earn respect, so he faked it. He lied about jobs and qualifications and accomplishments to impress others, always trying to project like this incredible version of himself that just didn't exist. He reminds me very much, and I'm blanking on the guy's name, but we discussed him in my episode about the murder in Nantucket.
Oh, Beth Lochtefeld.
Yes. I forget the killer's name because he's not worth remembering. But yeah, but he was just very much gave off that same thing. Like he wasn't good enough. So he pretended to be something he was not. Ian dreamt of being a pilot in the Royal Army, and he would meet girls and tell them about his wild and glamorous and also imaginary career, because the real story was that he was working like low-wage jobs in factories or warehouses.
I'm sure. It's not as cool as pilot, though, so of course you gotta pump it up.
You gotta pump it up, exactly. Or like, I read one thing where he got a job as like a manager of a store, but he told people he was gonna go run their Caribbean branch. And I'm like, oh. Cool, you got a promotion. That's great. Why do you have to make it so ridiculously outlandish?
Yeah, because they have something wrong with them in their minds about where they just think nothing is good enough.
So in December of 1994, 20-year-old Ian met and began dating 18-year-old Claire Evans. And he managed to lie and manipulate his way right into her heart. And within just a few weeks, he had convinced Claire to marry him. This fairy tale abruptly ended, however, as Ian couldn't maintain the charming facade for very long. They never can. He was abusive and violent towards Claire, and she soon found solace in the arms of another man, Ian's younger brother, Wayne.
Oh, no.
Which isn't great. Like, we already know that Ian felt threatened by his younger brother's very existence.
This is a Springer episode waiting to happen.
Oh, wait. It doesn't help that Wayne was essentially living Ian's dream as he was an engineer with the Royal Army.
Oh my God. Oh no. That's where he got the pilot from. He's picking things out of people's lives that he wants to emulate or he wants to be like and just
Yeah. So he's living his dream, then to find out that his wife had left him for his brother, this didn't go over well.
Ticking time bomb.
Yeah. Ian refused to grant Claire a divorce, and he actually wouldn't end up signing the papers until 1999. So he just kept dragging it out for like 4 or 5 years.
Man.
So while he and Claire were legally married, although they were separated, Ian continued preying on young women and girls. And by girls, I mean 11 or 12 years old.
Come on.
He was a sick fucking monster. The BBC has a whole list of his disgusting crimes against children and the rapes he allegedly committed. I'm not going to go through all of them because this episode would be 6 weeks long. But just to cover a few of them, again, this is all on the BBC website. In August of 1995, when Ian was 21 years old, he was investigated by police and social services for being in a relationship with a 15-year-old.
15.
Which, a six-year difference when you're 30 and 36, no big deal.
Totally different than this.
A six-year difference at 15 and 21 is a big-ass deal.
Light years.
So he was investigated, no action was taken. In March of 96, he was investigated by social services again for a relationship with a child under the age of 16. No action was taken. The following month, investigated again for the same crime with the same useless outcome. In May of 1996, he was investigated yet again for hurting a 13-year-old child. I don't know exactly what that entailed. It just said hurting a 13-year-old. I believe the child later recanted. My guess is due to being in fear of Ian.
Yeah.
So I can imagine being like, no, okay, it didn't happen, you know? So in April of 1998, a report was made by a woman who said Ian had attacked her. Oh, but there just wasn't enough evidence. Are we seeing a pattern here? And I'm not even going through everything that this guy has done.
Well, and it makes sense now what you were saying in the beginning about sometimes when you talk about the system failing people, it's like a broken record. And I'm like, okay, Melissa, yeah, the system failed them. But then we see blatant evidence of it every single week we do a case. It's like, I feel like every story has some kind of thing involved in it, some kind of milestone that happens that could have been completely avoided if X, Y, and Z was done when it was supposed to be done.
Exactly. And that's what I meant by the system failed these girls long before the police got involved in, like, with Holly and Jessica. Around that same time, like around 1998, Ian was at a nightclub where he became fixated on this one woman who was on the floor dancing. And according to sources, like, he attempted to, like, dance with her and engage her throughout the night to no avail. Well, when this woman leaves the club, unbeknownst to her, Ian follows her. And at some point, she cuts through an alley, and this is when Ian attacks and rapes this woman. He threatens her to stay quiet, and at some point, he, like, turns around or something so she's able to escape. She runs home and immediately calls police. So when the authorities go to investigate, and I use that term very loosely, their investigation came down to it being a he said, she said, with him claiming it was consensual. And then when witnesses at the club were interviewed, all they can say is, well, yeah, we saw Ian and this woman talking. So yet again, the case is dropped due to lack of evidence. According to an episode of the show, The World's Most Evil Killers, I think it was season 1, episode 3 on Ian Huntley, there are estimates that Ian may have preyed on and had some sort of inappropriate relationship with up to 60 girls.
60 girls. Wow. And again, hearkening back to that news, that first news clip, that was the first time I'd ever seen Ian Huntley talk and move and project himself. You would not think that guy had anything to do with anything. Very innocuous.
Exactly. And guess how many times that he was held accountable for that?
Zero.
Zero times. A whopping zero times. What would happen is he would get in trouble in one town. He would just pick up and move to another. And for a while, he even went by the name of Ian Nixon, which was his mother's maiden name. And I said this at the beginning, I'm not entirely comfortable with the criminal justice system in England, so bear with me. But prior to this case of Holly and Jessica, there wasn't like a central database for all of the different authorities to share information. So Ian is essentially just going from town to town, changing his name, and it's like no one's keeping track of him.
Yeah, he's unchecked because they don't have a way to keep up.
Exactly. And like, I do want to clarify, England did have a database for sexual predators that was started in 97, but that's only if they had been convicted, which, as we know, Ian was never held accountable.
Right.
So at some point in 1997, so Ian would have been about 23 or so, he began a relationship with a 15-year-old girl named Katie. And I feel icky about even calling it a relationship. Like, let's just call it what it is. A grown-ass man was raping a 15-year-old child. So he worked with this girl's mother, and when he found out that this woman had a teenage daughter, his pervert radar started dinging, and he managed to worm his way into this woman's life, and unfortunately, Katie's life as well. And this poor girl was infatuated with him, and I get it. A 15-year-old is too naive to realize that she's being preyed upon. Like, you think this adult man thinks you're attractive, and at 15, like, he's so worldly and mature, and you don't realize that no one his age would give him the time of day because he's a shitbag.
That's the reason that age of consent exists. And that's the reason it's 18, because that's the reason they don't want 15-year-olds making these kind of decisions with all these new emotions and floating through their head.
Oh my gosh. And some like good looking older boy says you're pretty. Holy shit. Right. Of course. Like 100%. I get it. Well, Ian managed to woo her, and once he had her in his grasp, the charming facade dropped completely, and he began to manipulate and abuse her. Thankfully, Katie managed to get out of the relationship alive. Unfortunately, though, at 15 years old, she was pregnant with Ian Huntley's child.
No.
Their daughter, Samantha, was born in 1998. And we're going to come back to Samantha because she is a beautiful, brave, intelligent young woman. So hold tight on her, but she's great. Awesome. So in February of 1999 is when Ian met Maxine Carr at a nightclub. And she was there with a friend of hers who was also like a friend of Ian's. And Maxine would later say it was love at first sight, at least for her. After only 4 weeks of dating, the pair moved in together.
Ooh, 4 weeks.
So now on to Maxine. So she would eventually take her mother's last name of Carr, but she was born Maxine Ann Kapp on February 16th, 1977, the second daughter to parents Alfred Kapp and Shirley Carr. Alfred and Shirley had a volatile relationship. Shirley eventually left him, taking the girls with her, and sadly, that was essentially the end of Alfred's relationship with Shirley and their daughters. So as Maxine grew older, she was considered timid and sort of a wallflower. She never did very well academically. Like, she kind of just floated along, if that makes sense.
It does. Makes total
and
sense.
As she grew into a teenager, she developed an eating disorder. It's very clear that she did not have a whole lot of self-confidence, which is definitely a shame. These insecurities led her to crave any kind of attention that she could get, especially from men. There were reports that she would go to clubs and drink heavily and then pretty much hook up with anyone who threw a glance her way. And like, I don't feel like that's necessarily a need to judge her. What I do find interesting is that in interviews with people who knew them, both Ian and Maxine were described by different people as Jekyll and Hyde characters. Hmm. Like, multiple sources said that about both of them. So Ian, just like what we've been saying this whole episode, he was generally a quiet and unassuming man until he became angry and he would become violent and full of rage.
Wow.
While Maxine was shy and introverted and even described as dowdy.
Oh, dowdy.
Until she began dowdy. I know, that one's mean. Like, I read that and I was like, man. Damn, guys.
Yeah.
But when she would when she would start drinking, she would get loud and flirty. And reports were about how she would, like, dance on tables and engage in exhibitionism. Yeah, wow. She's getting wild.
Down and dowdy.
Down and dowdy. So, like, as I was researching, I found it really interesting that Maxine and Ian both seem to have, like, these alter egos who they kind of hid behind these, like, unassuming personalities. So, anyway, after Maxine finished, like, the England equivalent to, like, high school, she worked at a factory with her mom before eventually enrolling in a school for higher learning as she longed to be a school teacher. And while working at this factory job, her coworkers would say that she was very immature and just constantly, like, daydreaming. And she had very few friends. She didn't really seem to have any interests or hobbies. She eventually did finish her secondary education, and she received some sort of diploma. However, she did not have the correct qualifications for the position that she would go on to work at St. Andrew's Primary School.
Oh, really?
It would come out later that she lied to get the job. And spoiler alert, right now, girl lies a lot. Damn dowdy liars. After about a year together in February of 2000, the couple decides to leave Grimsby and they move about 30 miles west to a town called Scunthorpe. Again, apologies if I mispronounced that.
So, these are great.
So while there, they lived in this apartment with a neighbor, and her name was Marissa. And this Marissa woman is in, like, every TV show about this couple. And it is clear that she cares a lot for Maxine. So she talks about how Ian was abusive. Like, she physically saw him laying hands on Maxine. And she talks about how they often fought. And she also talks about how one night there were police at Ian and Maxine's apartment. And I think it was the next day she gets a chance to talk to Maxine and she's like, what happened? Like, is everything okay? And Maxine proceeds to tell her that Ian had been accused of raping someone back in Grimsby. But
wow.
She knows he didn't do it. But Then she goes on to explain that Ian was always getting accused of rape and other crimes, and that's why they had moved to this other apartment, to get away from all of these horrible accusations.
All that does is make you look like an idiot.
Okay, so back to our investigation. They're in that 7-hour-long questioning at the police station. It's Friday, August 16th.
Yep.
And they're being asked about the girls and asked to talk about the night they went missing. And keep in mind, this is the first time the police are talking to Maxine. Like, the first time that they are talking to her.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the first time that they're talking to Ian since the day after the girls went missing. Other than, like, his random stupid-ass questions.
Yeah.
But this is, like, really the first interrogation kind of thing, which is wild to me that they're waiting till now to talk to Maxine 2 weeks after these girls went missing.
Major misstep.
Yeah. So while the pair is being spoken to, Maxine insists to police that Ian couldn't have hurt the girls because she was home with him the night that the girls stopped by. She had cooked a roast for dinner, and she even told them about the television programs that they watched on TV. Police buy her alibi, and they let the couple go home. After the 7 hours, the couple was released. Wow. However, while Ian and Maxine are at the station, the authorities were conducting searches of the couple's home and the Soham Village College. Uh-oh. And these searches would go really late into the night on August 16th, like into the morning of the 17th. And I'm just saying that because the timeline kind of gets a little wonky, but basically, we're in the early morning hours of Saturday the 17th. Okay. So while they're searching the home at 5 College Close, police again note the strong smell of cleaning products. And they also note that Ian's red Ford Fiesta had been meticulously cleaned and the tires had been replaced.
Mm.
So in the home, in addition to finding fibers that would later go on to be of importance, we'll get back to them. The police also found a set of keys, because remember how on that first night the girls went missing and that police officer wanted to search the school, but when it came to that building known as the hangar, Ian claimed he didn't have the keys?
Yep.
Yeah. Well, strangely enough, the keys were found. I think they were like under a mattress, because that's where I keep my keys.
Of course. Well, yeah.
So when authorities get into this building, they make a horrific discovery. In a trash bin were the charred remains of the clothing that Holly and Jessica were last seen wearing. The red Manchester United shirts, bits of their athletic pants, their shoes, and the girls' underwear had been burned and discarded in this trash bin. Authorities also realized that all of those fibers they found around Ian and Max's home were like fibers from these jerseys. So when the clothing items and the bin were examined, the forensic expert would find 5 human head hairs and a fingerprint, all of which belonged to Ian.
No wonder he didn't want him in that room.
Exactly. So they're finding all this stuff. And at this point, police are also getting several calls regarding Ian's interview with Jeremy Thomas from the day prior. All these callers are basically like, that lovely caretaker who was so concerned about the missing girls. Yeah, he's a fucking monster and he's been accused of raping and assaulting countless children.
Well, yeah, if he's been trying to hide out this whole time, obviously people know what he looks like because he's lived all these different places. So, yeah, the more notoriety he gets and the more this story gets blasted out, the better chance that somebody's going to recognize.
Right. Like, I don't know what he was thinking. I don't know. But later that day, Saturday, August 17th, Ian Huntley and Maxine Carr were arrested on suspicion of abducting and murdering Holly Wells and Jessica Chapman.
As they should be.
They were brought to separate police stations, and it was then that Maxine admitted that she had lied about being home with Ian the night the girls disappeared. In reality, she had been 110 miles away in their hometown of Grimsby visiting her mother.
Oh, no.
Ian, on the other hand, would continue to claim ignorance. And while he was at it, he very clearly began laying the groundwork for an insanity plea. While he's talking to the police, he begins drooling and becoming incoherent.
My favorite part of true crime in general is when perpetrators pretend to be insane.
Well, and he did such a ridiculous, like, it's laughable if this wasn't such a serious case. Like,
right.
And this would eventually lead to police having him hospitalized to have his mental capacity evaluated.
Wow.
So the same day these demons are arrested, Saturday, August 17th, a heartbreaking discovery is made just about 10 miles away in a remote, isolated section of land on the Lake and Heath U.S. Air Base. A groundskeeper and two others were investigating. They were kind of just walking around the area, but they were also investigating the source of a bad odor when they came across burned human remains in an irrigation ditch. And while it would take a few days for formal identification, as the bodies were in extremely bad condition, everyone knew that the search for 10-year-old Holly Wells and Jessica Chapman had come to the very worst possible conclusion that could happen.
It's kind of what everybody was suspecting, but it doesn't make it any easier.
No. And in addition to the little girls' bodies being found, some bits of clothing and a necklace that belonged to one of the girls had also been found in the area.
Got it.
So the announcement that they had found Holly and Jessica was made publicly the following day, and to say that the entire country was heartbroken would be an understatement.
I don't doubt it, and I'll bet you that they still have memorials or little. When I went to Delphi for that last project, there were still ribbons on all the, especially around the courthouse, like on all the lighthouses. So even all these years have passed, these girls are still remembered. So I guarantee that's the case in England too.
I'm sure it is. Well, now at this point, it's officially a murder, and Ian and Maxine, these two asshats, were never going to do the right thing, we know. So police need more evidence. And like, they had the burned remains of the girls' clothing and the t-shirts and or the jerseys, and they had those hairs and the fingerprints, but they needed more. They really needed something to link Ian to the girls' bodies on that airbase. And sadly, as I mentioned, the remains of these poor babies, they were in just such horrific condition that they were of very little use when it came to evidence. Police needed to concentrate on where the girls' bodies were found, which again, this is this expansive and rough terrain area, which, by the way, this was a favorite area of Ian's to go plane spotting, because remember, he had that fascination with army pilots.
Mm-hmm.
But he couldn't hack it because he can't do anything, right? Anyway, the police knew that they needed assistance to properly investigate this parcel of land. And this is where the girl power comes in. So allow me to introduce you to the incredible Patricia Wilshire.
Ooh.
She is a forensic ecologist, botanist, paleontologist, I think that's how you say it. And she is internationally recognized for developing scientific methods that use plant matter, pollen, spores, soil, and fungus to investigate crimes. Like, this insanely intelligent badass woman, she's assisted in over 300 police investigations across like England, Ireland, New Zealand, the Netherlands. And she's worked on several high profile cases, including the murder of Millie Dowler, the murder of Sarah Payne, and even the Ipswich serial murders.
I love forensic botany. I love when it gets down to soil types and leaves and spores and pollen and mold. And it's some of the coolest science that's ever existed.
This woman is so freaking cool. Like, you should do a mini on one of her cases because she is so interesting as a human. Like, she's so cool. She actually, I don't even have this in my script or anything, but she actually was sick as a child and her parents bought her encyclopedias to read. So like, while she was sick at home, like, cause she couldn't go to school, she just like read these encyclopedias, and she would go on walks with her grandma, and she just like found nature, I guess, just so interesting. And well, let's get to it, because how she did this is so freaking cool. And just in case you weren't already blown away by her credentials, she is widely regarded as the founder of modern forensic ecology.
Very cool.
She's able to like meticulously analyze this trace botanical evidence and then provide testimony and explain it all to a jury.
That's the key, because if you can be as smart as you want, if you can't make a jury understand your thought process and your processes, you need to find a way to take those smarts and present it in layman's terms so that everybody can understand what you're talking about.
As Patricia puts it, quote, It doesn't matter where we go in nature, we always leave a trail behind us. And I use these clues to pinpoint police in the right direction. End quote. So the authorities know they need help linking to where Holly and Jessica were found, not to mention where he would have like entered this area, because to the police, where they found the bodies was a very secluded area and they couldn't see anything to like show a disturbance as to how the bodies got into this like heavy foliaged area. So in comes our pollen princess, as I'm calling her. And she goes out to this airbase. Isn't that good? And she goes out to this airbase and looks specifically at the spot where the bodies were found. And she notices the area is heavily surrounded by nettles.
What the hell's a nettle?
You know those weeds that have like the little sharp edges on them and you go to try to pull them out of the sidewalk It like stings you kind of?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they actually have antioxidant, anti-inflammatory, and blood sugar lowering properties. Maybe I'm just going to start eating some nettle.
Oh, diabetes is cured.
Where's Ed? He's outside eating nettle.
He's outside eating the weeds.
Like a goat.
So she finds this specific section of nettles, like right where the bodies were found, and she said that they were going through, quote, corrective growth. And what she means is that they had been like flattened or stepped on, but they're now growing back. And get this, just by looking at these growing nettles, she could tell that they had been correctively growing for about 13 days.
Wow, and that's
how
incredible.
How long had the girls been missing?
13
about
days.
13 days. Isn't that wild?
Really awesome.
Like, just to be able to look at a plant and be like, oh, that got stepped on 13 days ago. What?
Insane.
Well, it gets better. As Patricia is showing them the path of these specific petals, there, caught on a twig, is a strand of Jessica's hair that the police had missed. So, like, now they know this is where the girls entered the ditch and the path that their killer took.
Wow.
The next thing the police do is ask Patricia to inspect the charred clothing that they had found in that trash bin, and our girl does it again. She's able to find several types of vegetation on clothing, and like all of these little bits of trees and plants and pollen, it all matched the vegetation exactly where the bodies were found, which means the girls were undressed after they were put in that irrigation
ditch. I was just going to say, that's exactly what that symbolizes.
Yep. So now, Patricia's next task is to inspect Ian's car. We know that he had cleaned it very well, and we know that he had changed the tires. So, like, they couldn't use tire treads or tire tracks or anything like that. But what Ian didn't clean very well was the chassis, which I had to look that up because I didn't know what that meant. But basically, it's the frame of the car. Yeah. I was like, yeah. I don't know what that is. Patricia was able to find and analyze these teeny tiny bits of like soil and dirt and vegetation that had been missed during the cleaning. And she could conclusively prove that it was the same exact soil and vegetation that had been found on the girls' clothes and at the site where the bodies were found.
So damn cool.
That's so freaking cool. I know. Like, this woman like blows me away. I'm like, you're so cool. So without having Patricia, like, the only real link between Ian and the girls was the burned clothing in that trash bin at the school, which I feel like any good defense attorney could argue that. But thanks to Patricia's knowledge and experience, they were able to place Ian at the site where the bodies were found.
Yeah, because otherwise anyone could have thrown these burned clothes out in my trash can. It wasn't us. We didn't do it. So unless there's camera footage of us doing it, you prove it.
Exactly. You don't know that we did it. So, on April 16th, 2003, Ian pled not guilty to the murders of Holly Wells and Jessica Chapman, and the trial was scheduled to begin on November 3rd, 2003. Maxine pled not guilty to her charges of perverting the course of justice and assisting an offender. So, about a month prior to the trial starting, Ian decided to start talking, because up until now, he had claimed he nothing to do with the murders. Well, now he decided to change his tune. And his story was that he was outside tending to his dog when Holly and Jessica stopped by and, oh no, Holly had a nosebleed.
Give me a break.
Yeah. Ian, being the helpful gentleman that he was, brought the girls inside and took them into the home's bathroom to assist with the nosebleed. While in the bathroom, Holly somehow fell into the bathtub, which, by the way, was filled with water, and she drowned.
How convenient.
Ian then claims Jessica became upset.
Oh, you think that your friend just drowned? Yeah, I'd say so.
So he claims that he's trying to calm her down, so he put his hand over her mouth, and she just suffocated and died.
They always have a story. The backpedaling. Okay, now I'm in deep shit. Now what can I say to make it sound not so? Again, just still trying to distance themselves.
Well, then he says both girls had died. He panicked and he drove the girls' bodies to where they were ultimately found.
But of course he would.
So Ian would continue this outrageous lie even on the stand, and then the prosecutor would give the following argument. And to this day, we still don't know what really happened inside that house, but I think this is probably the closest we're ever going to get to the truth.
Okay.
So just prior to Holly and Jessica walking past Ian's house on that fateful Sunday evening, Ian had been on the phone with Maxine, because remember, she was at her mom's house. And apparently this phone call had resulted in a very heated argument between the two, with Ian accusing Maxine of cheating on him and then hanging up on her.
Oh, wow.
It should be noted that there is some truth to this claim, as Maxine had gone out drinking and apparently was, like, caught kissing some guy. So anyway, Ian yells at Maxine, he hangs up and goes outside, and while he is seething with anger, Holly and Jessica happen to walk by. And police and prosecutors believe that they did stop and say hello and ask him how Maxine was doing after not getting that job. But instead of the conversation ending there, as Ian had claimed, they believe he lured them into the home by inviting them to come inside and see Maxine themselves.
That sounds like a very feasible possibility.
Agreed. And again, we're never going to know what happened inside that hell home, but it's believed that this monster killed Holly first and then Jessica. And because we know that Jessica's phone was turned off at 6:46 p.m., it would have probably happened within minutes of them entering the home.
I did a story like this it's funny, we talked about this show Face of Evil last time, but this is another reference. It was a situation, it was a New Jersey case where a guy had... They were in this roadside hotel and had a fight with his girlfriend, a humongous blow up. And he was a psychopath who just happened to storm down the highway and run into a homeless guy in one of those big sewer. It was like they were putting a new sewer line in. So it was a gigantic, you could walk right through it. Killed this dude right in that sewer pipe just because he was so pissed off at his girlfriend for something that happened. So what a terrible set of circumstances. Like what a random encounter that they would cross right at the time this was happening. How tragic.
So tragic. And I hate to even add this part, but I feel like I need to. We don't honestly know if the girls were sexually assaulted. Some reports said that they thought maybe one of the girls had been, but as I said, the remains were in such horrific condition. I don't think it could ever be conclusively proved one way or the other. With that being said, Ian Huntley is a sick bastard with a list of rape allegations longer than my arm. So do with that what you will.
You hit it on the head because he 100% sexually assaulted those girls based on his history alone.
I completely agree. He was a sick, sick human. So on December 3rd, 2003, Maxine took the stand and admitted that she was a liar. She claims that if she knew what Ian did, she never would have lied for him. However, it should be noted that Ian told Maxine that the girls were in the home and something bad happened. And because of all those allegations from his past, he just knew that the police would assume it was him, which is why she needed to give him an alibi.
Of course.
And again, I understand she was abused by him. I'm not making light of that, but I just think that she was not a good person. It would take the jury 5 days to reach a verdict. On December 17th, Ian Huntley was found guilty of murder of both Holly Wells and Jessica Chapman. He was given 2 life sentences by the judge and sent to a high security prison. It was later decided that he had to spend 40 years at minimum behind bars. I don't quite know. Like, I know that a life sentence in other countries isn't always a life sentence. So, but he's still in jail. He will hopefully die behind bars. Maxine was found guilty of perverting the course of justice, but not for being an accomplice. She was sentenced to like 3.5 years. She ended up serving 21 months. And then this pisses me off. She was granted a new identity.
Oh, God.
You should have to live with what you know you did, ma'am.
But she does, though. Every night she thinks about where she is and what happened. I guarantee you that. But at the same time, I think she got a fair sentence because there's no proof aside from a couple of us going, did she say was? Those girls weren't? You know what I mean? There really isn't any hard evidence that she was involved in it. So, and it sounds like perverting the course of justice is the equivalent of like interfering with an investigation.
Yeah. It should be noted that Ian has been attacked several times in prison. Somebody stabbed him. Somebody threw boiling water on him. I can't say that I feel bad. Kind of think it's great.
Deserves every bit of it.
Because of this case, a database was created. I believe it rolled out in 2011. So now if a police force in Northern England has an issue with someone, every other police force is going to know about it now.
That's awesome, man. That's all you can hope for in a case like this. It's so tragic, so senseless that something good comes out of it. And the good part is this guy's in jail. He cannot hurt any more women or girls under 16 as he had done in the past. But also now we have a new law in place and some new techniques and new advancements in place because of it.
And just real quick, Ian's daughter, Samantha, I believe that she's doing very well. Wild story how she found out about her father when she was 14 in school. They were all assigned a serial killer or murderer or some sort to research. And that is how she found out who her father was.
Wow. Just incredible.
She seems to be doing very well. And that's all we can hope for her. I mean, I'm sure it's a lot to deal with, but she and her mom, Katie, seem amazing. They are on one of the TV shows. I think it's called, like, My Life with a Killer, something similar. Unfortunately, I couldn't get it in the States.
I'll help you with that. You need a VPN.
Yeah, I don't know those fancy things. I know Google.
I'll help you. Yeah,
so I couldn't watch it, but...
Oh,
anyway,
we'll watch.
So that is the case of the Soa murders.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. That was kind of a crazy story, and I know it involves some not so great subject matter with the younger victims, but important to hear. I mean, that people like this are walking around.
Mm-hmm. And just can be so like hidden out in like in the real world, like hiding in plain sight.
Yep. Well, let us know what you think, guys.
Yeah, hit us up on our socials, Facebook, Insta, TikTok, Blue Sky, at Murder Unscripted. Email us at murderunscriptedpod@gmail.com or drop us a line through our website, www.murderunscriptedpod.com.
That's it. And what do we got next week?
What do we got next week? Oh, we have the case that will then lead into our guest in the fourth week.
That's right. I should probably start writing it. Well, actually, Candace, our research producer, is back in the mix, and she's helping us with this one. So Candace and I are going to kind of tag team. This is a big case that needs some special attention, and it'll all make sense when we announce our guest.
This is a huge case, and this is honestly one that I really never wanted to cover because the subject matter is extremely dark. Extremely dark. Be prepared for that one, but it's an important one and we do need to cover it. So that's next week, then our guest, and then we have one more case to tie the month up, which I believe will be featuring our girl Cece Moore as our badass babe.
Ooh,
in that episode.
Cece, who never got back to me. But yeah, that's cool.
Stay tuned for that. No hard feelings. I don't cry myself.
No, no, I'm totally okay with it.
I do, but for different reasons. So it's fine.
Yeah, I don't even think about
anyway,
it.
Anyway.
Doesn't even bother me.
On that note, be nice, be kind, and remember, especially after today's episode, perverts don't wear signs that say they're perverts. They may pervert justice.
They may pervert justice, or they may give innocuous news interviews, pretending they don't know what's going on. Oh, they may insert themselves into investigations.
Good. Also, I'm going to start a petition to get it changed in the United States to perverting justice, just because I like the way that sounds.
Oh my God. You know how many more people would be in jail for perverting things? So many.
Oh my God, you'd be locked up. Bye!